You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of public service at the College of the Ozarks. Joining me today on the show is Nathan Gilmore, English teacher at North Gwinnett High School. Nathan, summer's almost over. Did you have a good one?
I did, and summer is entirely over on my side. I just got done teaching my third day of high school for the new year, and looks like I've got a good bunch of kids, so I'm not even all that disappointed that summer is over. Over on the network is cooking along. We've still got some new episodes of Before They Were Live coming out on the... Oh, phooey. I can't... Coyle, how many tales are there of Scheherazade?
Oh,
is
I
it
don't
a
know.
Thousand and One
thousand
Nights?
Thousand and One. Yeah, sure. I don't know.
Yeah, let's say 1,001. And also there are some interviews coming out on Christian Humanist Profiles. Among other things, I've done some interviews on the Theology of the Devil, on Immanuel Kant and a new theory about Immanuel Kant's philosophy that he was establishing a spiritual community there in 18th century. What part of Germany was he in? Prussia? Let's say Prussia. And interesting stuff going on. So looking forward to hearing what the listeners think of it. But today, Coyle, you are indulging me as I trot out a thought experiment that occurred to me, and I'm going to talk to our listeners a little bit about the facts, first of all, that led me to this thought experiment. So here's the first fact. According to a few different sources that I've read, the Biden 2020 campaign spent about $1.2 billion on advertisements, canvassing, and other things that political campaigns spend money on. A couple other sources that I looked at said that the Biden 2024 campaign and the Harris 2024 campaign combined to spend about $1.2 billion. In both of those cases, they just soared above what the Trump campaign raised. So that's the first set of facts. The second set of facts, modern electoral college presidential contests tend to hinge upon swing states so that a relatively small number of votes, three digits in the case of Florida in 2000, often four digits or low five digits in swing states, determine the outcome, while more reliably Republican or Democrat states become background rather than battleground. So let's say in a given election, 70 million people vote. A given swing state might differ by 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 votes, throwing all of those winner-takes-all electoral college votes to one candidate or the other. And because of the great sort and other factors, tends to move the election one way or the other. So, for instance, my own state of Georgia has become a swing state in recent cycles. So, for the first time since I moved here in 2002, in 2024, every commercial break during every show on every channel was a presidential ad. And it was that way for most of 2024. So, Coyle, here's my thought experiment. Academics, as a demographic, are among the most mobile folks in the country. Academics will move thousands of miles to take a professorship, and in most cases, we don't even think twice about it. Academics will uproot families, leave towns, otherwise become transients if there is a professorship on the other side of the move. So professors as a group also tend to be progressive politically. So for everyone Coyle Neal, there might be 10 or 15 progressive voting academics. All right. Now, the administrative apparatus that is now moving in swarms wherever you've got professors also tends to vote blue, according to what I've read. And they also seem to be just about as mobile as the faculty, pardon me. When there is a new vice president of this or that, they're just as likely to be moving in from another part of the country as they are to be local. So here's the question that arises from this. I started imagining, what if the DNC took some of those $1 billion in change that don't seem to be doing much right now to win elections? What if they rented and renovated whatever structures are abandoned in dozens of small town main streets and opened up liberal arts colleges in Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Wisconsin, other projected swing states early in any given president's term? The money wouldn't have to fund the colleges entirely. They would still charge tuition, I would still imagine. But they would subsidize them as much as they could so that they'd be in better shape financially than the Christian private colleges that I've been a professor for. So 3.5 years later, they would have well-established blue-leaning pockets outside of the big cities, ready to see their three-year inhabitants of their new states pulled from strategically irrelevant deep blue university towns and urban areas into more strategic locations electorally, and those folks would head out to the polls. So, Coyle, that is the thought experiment. I have a hunch that there are significant legal problems, there are significant financial problems, and there are significant tactical problems, and there might even be a fourth category of problems that I'm not anticipating yet. So I want you to take it from there. What is the biggest problem with that thought experiment, and where would you start to outline why it's a problem?
Well, I don't know that there are any legal or political or tactical problems. $1 billion will solve a lot of problems for you, right? You can start a school anywhere you want, anytime you want, and there, as far as I know, there are processes that you have to go through, but you know, people go through them, like schools open and schools close and so forth. I would guess, and this is none of what you have talked about so far is in my area of expertise, but I would guess the biggest issue you would probably run into is accreditation. That's going to be the hitching point for it is, I just don't know. And if I were a more responsible podcaster, I've got a friend who's a higher up in the HLC. I would have reached out to this accreditor friend of mine and said, hey, what would you guys do with a school that started explicitly for partisan purposes? I suspect the answer would be we'd accredit it if it's academically responsible, but I don't, that might be the one hitch I could foresee. I'm not aware of any laws that say, well, you can't open a Democratic school in a Republican state or vice versa, right? I don't know about that. I mean, there's presumably no reason a bunch of wealthy Republicans couldn't do exactly the same thing and buy up some real estate in New York City and open a conservative school right in the middle of it. They tried that once, actually, with King's College, and that went a different direction. But so that would be right. That would be where
and,
I'd say.
And I believe they're doing the same in Austin, Texas right now, if I remember right.
Yeah, there's a couple of schools
I remember hearing ads for it. Yeah, yeah.
UTX or something. I forget the name off the top of my head, which is terrible because I have friends
that
work
right
there. which is interesting because they've picked the island of blue in Texas, right? They're really not, they're not being brave and bold by starting a conservative school in Texas. It's just
right,
Austin
right.
is different. I would think that would be the major sticking point. Would be, is your school actually going to be viable as a school? Are you going to have everything that you need to make a university work? All of the financial side of things, and I realize. Campaign spending is always a challenge, right? $1.2 billion is an immoral amount of money to spend trying to win a political office. I don't think any reasonable person would disagree with that, with all sorts of caveats that need to be thrown in there, right? It's not necessarily the case that all of that is spent by the candidate. There are PACs and there are super PACs, and there is money that the party is spending that the candidate is not necessarily tied to any of that. So, I mean, there's a lot of nuance and caveats that have to go into that. You know, technically, if I go out and spend, $20 to run an ad in my local paper in favor of Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or Donald Trump or whatever, that counts towards that, even though Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and Donald Trump would never know anything about it. I would also never do that. But if I were to do that, that gets thrown into the pot as well. So those numbers are, they're not bad numbers. They're just numbers that need caveats and nuance. And if we wanted to go the full campaign spending thing, it is also important to ask, why are they spending so much money on a campaign? And the answer is, whoever spends the most money wins. There is a reason that money gets spent.
Except that hasn't been happening recently.
So, as is often the case with the presidency, we have to throw a little footnote in for Donald Trump. He is sometimes an exception. Although even here, the question is, does he count as an exception? So even if the money wasn't directly spent through donations and then by him and by his PACs, in 2016, the Republicans still outspent the Democrats. They just largely spent it on senatorial and gubernatorial races. So as much money was given and spent, it just wasn't spent on the Trump campaign, in part because some of the historic Republican donors were so disgusted by Donald Trump, they redirected their funds. But the overall amount of spending was still more on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. In 2024, the Democrats did outspend the Republicans. But then you have to ask the question, did Donald Trump get sufficient free airtime, both by virtue of being a former president running for a non-sequential term, and by virtue of being Donald Trump, that he got that value? He got the equivalent of another $1 billion worth of free airtime. So even though he didn't actually spend the money, they still functionally more was put into it. Again, Biden and Harris did outspend, and I guess that's the other caveat is you have to ask whether you count Biden and Harris as one lump sum of spending, or do you have to divide them up and count that as two different campaigns because they're two different people running for office. Harris only had 2 months or something like that to actually do her campaigning.
Right. I forget the title of her book, but
that, yeah.
If I remembered it, I would know.
All of that has to be accounted for. The real exceptions are the interesting ones, I think, are back in the 1990s, Steve Forbes ran for president. And he massively outspent all of the other Republican candidates, but it was all his own money. And then when he didn't win the primary, that becomes kind of a footnote. And then in 2020, I'm sure those of us who were paying attention to the internet all remember Michael Bloomberg's campaign, because you could not... Oh, yeah. Log on to a website without seeing a Bloomberg banner. And again, that was him spending his own money too, and he didn't win for lots of reasons. But those are sort of the real exceptions. Trump, political scientists argue about whether Trump is actually an exception or whether it's the same amount of value being spent, just being spent in different ways.
So in
that's
other
not
words,
what we're talking
I mean,
about.
Yeah, the non-consecutive terms you're saying is a much bigger variable than I'm giving it credit for, because right now what I'm looking at is 2024, if I remember right, and unfortunately I didn't put this number in the notes, I really should have, but I feel like between the two of them, the Biden and Harris campaigns outspent the Trump campaign substantially. We're not talking about 5%, we're not talking about 10%, we're talking about maybe 80% more than the Trump campaign spent.
I'd have to go back and look at the numbers. Again, it's not so, I mean, non-consecutive term, that's interesting, politically, historically, that's interesting. But I think that is one of the features that gave Donald Trump extra press coverage, along with him being Donald Trump. That again, even if he wasn't actually buying the airtime, he was still getting the financial value from the airtime. So he was getting $1 billion worth of free discussion on CNN and Fox News, certainly Fox News and MSNBC. And even if all they were doing is saying how much they hate him or how much they love him, it's still free airtime that none of the other Republican candidates in 2024 got. They got mentions now and then, but nothing substantial, certainly nothing on that scale.
All right. So, I mean, to follow up on that, then, what I think I'm hearing from you is that the airtime still does matter. I mean, the sense that I got from looking just at the spending numbers. Well, that's what I'm asking. I mean, it seems like when one side is outspending the other side by that much, that maybe the airtime isn't doing the work that it used to do. But you're saying that the airtime is still doing the work that it used to do.
Yeah.
It's just that one side is getting it for free.
Right. I guess if you want to put it this way, the Trump campaign, even if they massively, they spent way less than the Biden and then Harris campaigns, he still got the value as if he had spent that much money. Right, as if he had spent that much, invested that much into campaign advertising and bumper stickers and ads and all of the stuff that you spend your campaign money on, consultants and specialists and all of that. So I went down a rabbit trail on that, and I'm sorry, I shouldn't have. None of that answers your questions about the university.
It's the mechanics of the campaigns that I'm curious about.
Yeah, and again, this isn't my area of expertise. So everything you've said so far is kind of big intro level overview stuff that I cover in my intro class. Where does the money come from? How is it spent? Those are all, that's where you start getting into the details. And I know less about that. And some of that is going to vary depending on which office you're talking about. So congressional offices will often run on loans rather than on direct donations. Mm-hmm. And then they have to do fundraising afterwards to pay back, which becomes a challenge if you lose, because who wants to donate to a loser? That's less true with the presidential campaign, right? Because you have more direct donations going in. All of which to say, you would have to ask the question, what value would you get if you're managing a campaign and someone brings this idea to you of, hey, let's try to create more swing states by planting a university here. And if I'm a campaign manager and I say, I've got $1.2 billion and that's going to, I don't know how much it would cost to start a university. I mean, if you figure every faculty member is going to work for minimum wage and you'll need, 20 administrators working for six-figure salaries, where are we, where's that going to leave us? We'll need, 20, $30 million just to get it off the ground, assuming that you're not having to build anything. That'd be a hard sell.
And that's why in my thought experiment, this was a rent and renovate project rather than a build new structures project.
Oh yeah. I'm assuming that too. That's a chunk of funds that could be turned into bumper stickers or ads or hiring celebrity and endorsements or whatever.
So, I mean, and honestly, this is the part of the campaigning part that I didn't know about and my thought experiment was trying to get at. So you're actually going exactly where I wanted you to go. Are the parties looking for alternatives to advertising, to the kinds of operations that have run campaigns before because of this spending disparity? What I seem to be hearing from you is, no, they're not looking for that because as far as we can tell, the mechanics are still the same. It's just the funding model got a little bit wonky these last few cycles.
Yeah, and of course, the real issue there is, even if we assume that everything that you've suggested 100% would work, which maybe it would. I have no idea, right? It's an interesting idea, and I want to talk about the merits of it because I love the idea of forcing conservatives to go live around liberals and liberals to go live around conservatives, or not forcing, but encouraging. It's a great idea, and I'm 100% in favor of it. But the real obstacle, I think, would be that what you're talking about is an investment in the next campaign or even two election cycles down the road. And parties do not think that way. They think the election cycle that is immediately in front of you, if it won't help me win tomorrow, then I don't care about it. I'm not interested in long-term thinking. I'm interested in what works right now. So if it will not help me win the midterm election in 2026, then I'm not spending anything on it. I'm not investing in it. I need to invest in stuff that will help me win.
Okay.
Now.
So let me ask you this. That is the way that the mindset is currently. Speculate a little bit for me. I mean, if one of the parties did start playing chess six moves ahead instead of thinking about next week, would there be any potential advantage to that, or is politics such a game that things change so fast that you really can't make those kinds of long-term plans?
Well, yeah, the other party would win, right, is what would happen, is the other party would come out on top, and then they would be in a position that whatever plans you've made, they can derail because they're now the party in power. So once upon a time, you had party leaders who were able to do that, and the story that I've heard, which I haven't confirmed, but my source is pretty solid on it, was back in 1912, when Wilson was running as a Democrat, and there were questions about who was going to be running as a Republican, and Teddy Roosevelt was making noises about wanting to run, and the Republican Party leadership basically said no. He believes things that are out of step with a lot of Republicans, and we would rather lose an election than even potentially win an election with someone who's out of step with the Republican Party. That idea is just gone. We'll win again 4 or 8 years down the road rather than compromise our principles or cripple the party in such a way that it's harder for us to win once this guy's gone. Nobody thinks like that in the party apparatus anymore. And it would be a hard sell, in part because you know, if you're a congressman and your political party comes along and says, hey, we're going to do this thing and it means you're going to lose the next election, well, you're not going to go along with that, right? You're not going to put yourself out of a job for the long-term good of the party. You're going to do what you can to win an election for your own short-term good.
So this is interesting, Coyle, because again, I am someone who is certainly interested in politics. I mean, that's why I'm co-hosting a politics podcast with you. I try to stay informed on these things. And like I said, I mean, the question that really kind of inspired my thought experiment is, I think we're getting at it now. Does a political organization, whether one of the current parties, and it pretty much have to be one of the current parties because that's who's got the resources right now, do they have the capacity, do they have the imagination to do this kind of gambit play where you sacrifice a piece in order to get position? You seem to be saying that the pieces themselves will revolt.
Well, they would sacrifice a piece for the purpose of winning the immediate next election. They would not sacrifice a piece for winning an election two or three or four cycles down the road. I'm not saying that a political operative wouldn't say this is a good idea, but getting them to invest in it, that's going to be a harder sell. You would almost be better to go directly to the donors themselves. Make the pitch that, hey, what we really need is, and there's some of that going on, right? There is investment by left-wing organizations in rural America and right-wing organizations to a lesser extent in urban America. Is happening. It's just not happening with campaigns and politics. It's happening on the social side of things. I've got a friend who lives up in St. Louis who's working with an urban renewal organization. This friend is very deeply libertarian, conservative, but working in a deep blue city. And then I know of other organizations that are working to sort of revitalize rural communities, but they are on the progressive left. So it just depends. That work is going on, but you're not going to get the parties involved. At least I would be surprised if you could do that.
Okay. Yeah, and like I said, I mean, the other reason that it occurs to me is because the numbers seem to be so reliable, right? I mean, at least within, I'm going to say the last 25 years, so I mean, I guess 26 years, going back to the election of 2000, right? I mean, massive amounts of money being spent, massive amounts of ads being run in these swing states, and it still comes down to a few thousand votes, right? So that's why I thought actually moving a population not into one of the reliably blue states like New York or California, but into Georgia or into North Carolina or into Pennsylvania to sway that by a few thousand. It seems like that's something someone would have tried, but what I hear you saying is that kind of long-term strategy just isn't something that the parties do for whatever reason. And I realize I'm repeating myself, Coyle, but I mean, yeah. What I'm trying to figure out is, are there people saying, let's attempt that? Or is that something that isn't even on their radar for reasons that I'm not understanding?
Yeah. Again, it's the, I think some of what's throwing me a little bit is the intentional attempt, to the best of my knowledge, that's not really happening. And I don't know everything that's going on in the country, so maybe it is. And if someone out there is listening and knows of it, they can write in and let us know. Now there is some unsorting going on. Right? So we've mentioned the great sort, where we kind of shuffle ourselves into conservative and liberal enclaves. Some of that is being undone in the wake of COVID. You had a kind of, not quite a mass migration, but a large migration of people from the cities to more rural communities. And occasionally that has meant people moving from blue cities into red states. So Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico have all been beneficiaries of that, where people leave California and move in these red states. Started happening in Colorado years ago, to the point where Colorado is now a blue state. It was purple. It was a swing state for a while. Right. Now I think I'm comfortable just saying it's a blue state. It's going on in Montana. It's going on in Wyoming. On the other hand, you've also had some historically blue states where you have conservatives maybe either moving into those, or as the liberals leave, those start to turn purple. So the Rust Belt, right? Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, mm-hmm. Wisconsin. I mean, in the 2000 election, it would have been unimaginable that Wisconsin would be a swing state. Same thing in 2004, and same thing in 2008, and yet for the last three elections, it has been. Same thing with Michigan, same thing with Pennsylvania, right? Those were part of the blue wall once upon a time. Now, as people move around, that's starting to change. In that sense, the idea of a swing state, it's obviously true, right? So you mentioned the 2000 election, mm-hmm. Where Florida determined it, right? It all came down to who was going to win Florida.
Sure.
It wasn't the only swing state at the time. It was Florida, Ohio, and Colorado. I mean, today,
and Pennsylvania.
In 2000?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I don't remember that. But so Pennsylvania, so three states, right? Four states.
Right. Right.
I mean, today, Florida is maybe less of one. So if we drop them off, it's Georgia, it's North Carolina, it's mm-hmm. Virginia to some extent, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Minnesota has been super close. It's gone blue for the last three elections, but in 2016 it was within one percentage point. So I mean, it was a very mm-hmm. nearly a red state. Nevada, New Mexico, Montana. I mean, the number of swing states, it's getting larger, and it's almost large enough that we have to come up with a different term for it, because there will come a point when there are so many of them that. We need. They're not really just a few states determining it. It's now a large. It's a block of states that are scattered all over the country, that are determining an election, which is kind of what should be happening.
Right. Right. So the sense you're getting is that instead of having four swing states in the future, we might have 16 or 20.
We currently have, right, 16 or 20. That's not in the future. That's right now. I mean, how many states must someone win in order to become president? It's not just Ohio and Florida and Colorado anymore. It's now this block of states that are in play, that historically have been one color or the other, but all of a sudden now they're not.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to ask a historical question that's related to this, because the Federal Elections Commission favors the Democrats and Republicans to such extent that, at least in my lifetime, only Ross Perot has ever made much of a splash as a candidate who's neither a Republican nor a Democrat. So my own dabbler's sense of history is that those two parties started to get the protection that they currently enjoy around the time that Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party were starting to look like a genuine threat to, you know, make some actual headway in national politics. How coincidental are those events, the sort of peak of socialist influence in the early 20th century and the establishment of the Republicans and the Democrats as the two-party system? Are those coincidental? Does one cause the other? Am I too busy hunting for conspiracies here?
Well, probably. I don't really buy the conspiracy thing. We have mostly always had a two-party system. Like even the 19th century, even with the rise of the socialists at the beginning of the 20th century, it was still a two-party system. Really, if you're looking for a single, like a mono cause, which I don't think you should, but if you must one, it would be the collapse of the Prohibition Party with the passage of the 19th Amendment. Like that was a viable third party that was. Large and successful to the point where it affected the U.S. Constitution, and then there's a term for it, but the unification, the joining of the Populist Party with the Democrats, in the beginning mm-hmm. of the 20th century, where there was another third party that was viable and was large and growing and successful and had won offices at the state and federal level, and then rather than keep going, they teamed up, they melded together with a larger party. So I don't know that there's a conspiracy, and I honestly, the FEC, they don't decide who the political parties are. Like they acknowledge which parties are doing well. I forget what the cutoff is for the things that the FEC does, and that's in some ways going mm-hmm. to be less important than what goes on at the state level anyway. But it's like a 1 or 2% of the popular vote in the previous election. I'd have to go back and look at what the exact number is, but the amount of votes you have to get to kind of trigger being treated like the Republicans or the Democrats by the FEC, and then usually also at the state level, it's pretty small. Like, if we had third parties that weren't a bunch of crackpots, they would easily meet that. But we don't, because the reality is the main two parties, and here's my defense of the two-party system. In the United States, the two parties really do capture most of the people who care about politics. There are exceptions. I would be one of those exceptions. I despise both of the parties, but I also realize I'm an exception there. Like, the two parties really are broad enough that they include a good 80% of the American people, and given how few people vote or pay attention to politics, that's more than enough. Right? It's not like we're a if we were a European nation, that would be different. We'd have more diversity, more variety, but our parties are, each of the parties is big tent enough that we haven't really needed a third party to capture something that the Republicans or Democrats have just left sitting around on the ground.
Okay. So in other words, the people who are actually going to show up on Election Day are already pretty much encompassed by what the Republicans and Democrats offer. The people who want something else badly enough not to vote for a Democrat or Republican hasn't gotten substantial enough to actually trigger the public funding from election commissions.
Well, and because our parties, in order to, you know, be a viable candidate, and this is, and again, outside of my area of expertise, but my understanding is this is one of the differences between our party system and say, a European party system. If you want to be a candidate for office, you just stand up and say, I want to be a candidate for office. In the European system, the party recruits you, right? You're sort of brought up through the ranks internally. What that means is there's some self-selection that goes on. If there is something that people care about that the parties are not handling, some candidate is going to come along and say, hey, I care about this, and then they're going to win a primary, and that will then force the party to adjust. So parties tend to be fairly responsive, as we've seen in the last 10 years with the Republicans adjusting to the rise of populism and Donald Trump, right? He comes along and identifies something that the party had not been paying attention to, and now 10 years later, it's a completely different party. Something similar happens to the Democrats with Bernie Sanders. Now, they had some internal apparatus that stopped him from ever actually being the candidate, but the party has also adjusted, right? The Democratic Socialism that was kind of a fringe movement 10 years ago, it's not central, but it's a major voice in the party now. So if you are a Democratic Socialist, you have a party. If you are left-leaning but not a Democratic Socialist, you still have a party. And same thing on the Republican side, right? If you are a populist, there's a party for you. And if you are not a populist, there's still a party for you. We don't necessarily need a third party to come along and be one of those things. That the parties do that themselves.
All right. Well, I want to try out a philosophical. I can't decide whether it's a philosophical or a theological question. You can weigh in on that if you want. But one of the things that, you know, came to my mind as I was thinking about this is the question that I've been asking myself recently, because in the last two gubernatorial years in Georgia, which is the off year for presidential races, so 2022-2026, I have voted for the first two times in my life in Republican primaries, because Georgia has an open primary system. So if you show up on Election Day in non-presidential election year, they will ask you, do you want to vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary? In the past, I voted in the Democratic primary pretty reliably, but with 22 and 26, what changed for me was that there were candidates in the Republican primary who were very actively backing the election denial narrative. And then there were people who were frankly associated with Brian Kemp's gubernatorial cabinet, who had resisted the attempt to alter the results of the election. So I went in there, I voted for the people who were associated with the Brian Kemp cabinet. This last time in 2026, lost pretty significantly, so I'm not planning on voting for Republicans in the general. But here's the question that occurs to me is that I wonder what's the connection, I'll put it that way, between honesty and voting. So in other words, I am very obviously not especially aligned with the Georgia Republican Party, but I do know that there are some Georgia Republicans that are much worse than others in my eyes, so I will vote negatively to stop them, even though I don't positively support the people that I actually cast the vote for. Coyle, I guess here's the question. I mean, am I damaging my soul by engaging in this trickery, this chicanery?
I mean, I hope not, because I've done something similar in Missouri. So I actually, in 2016, I did vote in the Republican primary for Marco Rubio, and I somewhat regret that because it wasn't even close. But the Democratic primary was. So it was within a couple of thousand votes between Hillary and Bernie on the Democratic side of things. Now, my vote wouldn't have made a difference, but I do kind of wish I'd voted in the one that was closer than in the one that was a runaway. So in 2020, I did vote in the Democratic primary. I voted on that side of things, not because I particularly wanted a Democrat to win. I would be quite happy if all of them lost, and then if all of the Republican candidates lost too, I'd have been very happy.
Sure.
But I wanted to sort of sow chaos on the Democratic side of things because I was enjoying it as a political scientist. So I'm there with you a little bit on that one. I did vote for the candidate that I thought had some integrity, and then it turned out I was wrong. But I thought at the time this candidate was someone who was actually kind of willing to, even if I disagreed with him on issues, they were willing to act with integrity, and then down the road it turned out less so. But that said, I mean, obviously, voting in one sense, it is often, not always, but often a choice between the lesser of evils, and that's the result of living in a fallen world. That doesn't mean you don't do it. Doesn't mean you don't think carefully about it. Doesn't mean you don't try to vote with some integrity on your own part and hold your elected officials accountable once they're in office. But you should not go into it expecting, hey, I'm going to fix everything with my vote. That should never really be a thought.
Right. Oh, sure. And I hope I didn't give that impression with my scenario there. But yeah, what's interesting is in 22, the guy that I actually cast a vote for won, which is new for me because I've been voting not Democrat or Republican for president basically since 2000. So it's unusual for me to cast a vote and then discover that the person I voted for won. But like I said, in 22, that the main reason I voted in that primary was for the office of Secretary of State, because there was a GOP candidate who was openly campaigning on, we are going to do whatever it takes to overturn the 2020 election. And I said, all right, the guy who's running against him was the guy who actually was the Secretary of State in 2020. He's running for re-election. And I said, all right, I'd rather have that guy still in there, because even though he is a Republican down to his bones, he still takes his work seriously and his office seriously enough that he is going to say no when the question is, can you pull levers to make sure that this election ex post facto goes the direction that the president wants. Now, when that same guy tried to put his hat in the ring for governor this year, I voted for him again in my second Republican primary, and he got absolutely clobbered by someone who was absolutely branding himself as Trump Lite.
Yeah, and it's been a weird election year, kind of all around, at least so far. We're not through it yet. We just had our primary in Missouri, and again, there were some surprising results, which our listeners can go look up on the internet. They're getting a lot of attention and discussion. Missouri, Michigan, and I forget what the other state. There are three states that have had odd things going on, and
of course everyone's talking about Michigan.
Yeah. So yeah, well,
because the guy that hangs out with
the midterm cycle.
Absolutely. Yeah, in Georgia, unfortunately, it came down to the guy that I voted for, and then the guy that Trump endorsed, and then the guy who positioned himself as the new Trump, but outspent the guy that Trump endorsed by a significant margin. So going back to earlier in the episode, Coyle, it looks like even though I want this not to be true, television ad saturation really does work.
Well, and I'll give you a good counterexample. Our local state Senate election, there were three candidates running, and one of them had very deep pockets. He had a donor who had, I don't want to say bottomless funds, but had given a lot of money. So he massively outspent the other two candidates. But because it's a localish election, some of the money had gone to a political action committee that ran some incredibly negative personal attack ads, and that just utterly infuriated people. So even though he outspent, and even though he was a local incumbent, it was a state senate election, and he was a representative from part of the Senate district. He lost, and he even lost his own district, and it was entirely because of the negative ads that wasn't his fault. I mean, the PAC ran him; it wasn't connected to his campaign. So there are exceptions. There are footnotes and caveats where just spending money won't do it, but that's. Those are the exceptions rather than the rule.
Right, right. And it seems like the way that they spend money is still working. So, I mean, like I said, the question that kind of spurred my thought experiment, have the parties started thinking about, should we start spending our money differently, not to get money out of it, but to just take that money and use it otherwise? That hasn't really been on the table as far as for the two major parties.
No, they're always interested in trying new ways to win elections tomorrow, right? So if there's right now online advertising, right, is going to be a big chunk of the budget. So if someone figures out some new way to advertise, right, if Meta glasses are willing to beam an advertisement directly into your brain, well, they'll probably do that, but it will only be for tomorrow's election. It won't be for 4 years from now. I see we're coming up on our time, or at least we're coming to the end of our outline anyway. I will admit I had thought we were going to be talking like, what's the curriculum of this place going to be? What kind of faculty are we going to hire? Will they be D1? I mean, are the important questions here?
Well, what do you think? I mean, let's set aside, because I mean, I think that the conversation went in the direction that answers my questions. But since another side of the thought experiment is on your mind, I mean, what I had in mind was just a college that looked at, okay, if we're moving into Missouri, what kinds of job fields are big in Missouri, will offer only those majors. And again, just be very strategic about getting enough students in there for the short term, relatively speaking. Obviously, I wasn't thinking short term enough, but
sure.
In the short term, getting enough students in there that we can support these faculty and these administrators, and then keep them there long enough to alter the swing state election, right? But you're thinking that maybe these colleges would have some kind of curriculum to have a second prong to the strategy to do some cultural work as well, maybe.
Well, I mean, I was more thinking they have to teach something. Unless you're saying, which is found a diploma mill, and as long as they pay their tuition, they get their degree. It's an interesting thought experiment, but I think at the end of the day, part of the issue is you're bringing together all of the problems of modern party politics and smashing them with all of the problems of modern higher education. And so even things like how much is this school going to cost a student? If you're talking about starting a tuition free university, it's
Which
a great idea. That money's got to come from somewhere, right? So now if you're charging tuition. Now we're caught in the dilemma that every single college is facing of how much do you charge, right? And if you charge less, well, then you have less money to spend on your faculty, your staff, your facilities, your administrators, and so on. If you charge more, well, what's the draw? Why would a student want to go there as opposed to one of these other places that charges less? Especially if it gets out what the point of the school is, right? If it is known that this is a blue state colony being planted into a red state,
or a swing state.
Now where are your students going to come from? If they're only coming from in-state, are you targeting the demographic that is wealthy enough to attend? Or again, are you going to have some kind of subsidy so that anyone can come, but then that subsidy has to come from somewhere? And of course, are you actually going to pay your employees a median standard of living salary, and where's that money going to come from? And I know there's $1.2 billion that are being spent, but there's a lot of swing states too. And a single university could suck up $1.2 billion without thinking too hard about it. I was kind of interested in the logistics of it.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm thinking of the college where I used to be a professor, and the annual operating costs ran in the usually between 10 and 20 million, right?
Yeah.
Which is a significant hunk of change, right? But it's not $1.2 billion. So now,
you're dreaming too small. It easily could have been.
Well, yeah, it could have been. It could have been.
They could have spent $1.2 billion, Nathan. I firmly believe that.
I don't doubt that. And the things they would have spent it on just make me shudder.
That's one new football stadium right there.
Yeah, exactly. So let me ask this, Coyle. And again, I realize I'm getting away from higher ed again. And I apologize because now I'm...
No, it's fine.
Now I'm deliberately running away from where you want to talk about. But have there ever been organized efforts to relocate voters? So, I mean, I know, for instance, I mean, in the 1850s, I mean, you had people who would literally charge across the border from Missouri into Kansas. Yep. But as far as actually, I guess, for lack of a better adverb, legally resettling people so that they can affect electoral outcomes, I mean, it seems like with the devotion that people have to their political parties, that wouldn't be too big an ask. Has anyone tried it?
I mean, there are issues with that. So again, people do self-select. So we talked about the big sword at the beginning. People all the time move to be with others like them. Like, that's a regular occurrence. I won't use any specific examples, but we know people who move to where we're at to get away from the control of the other political party, right? I mean,
that
happens all the time. You pointed out Bleeding Kansas, right? That's sort of the infamous example of that. I don't know of any kind of top-down, let's intentionally kind of force people or strongly encourage people to move places for political reasons. In the early, late 90s, early 2000s, the Libertarian Party had a brief idea of let's pick a state with a low population and try to convince libertarians to move there so we can take over the state.
They
kind of whittled their options down to Wyoming or New Hampshire, and then they finally settled on New Hampshire because no one wanted to live in Wyoming. It didn't go anywhere. Like, it was already a fairly libertarian state, so you didn't actually need a large number of them to move there to make what they want to happen. And the libertarians just weren't willing to move in those kinds of numbers for partisan purposes. So I'm not aware of any time when that's been done. Now, obviously, there are times when to get back on to our higher ed topic, there are times when colleges have been started for specific purposes, sometimes even for specific partisan purposes. It's the location that I'm not sure about, right? Are there times when you have intentionally said, hey, this is ripe territory, it's on the bubble, it could tip over into our side if only we planted a college right there, and then 20 years from now, it'll be solidly on our team? That I don't know about, at least, again, in a partisan political purpose. Religiously, vocationally, all the time that sort of thing goes on. I mean, how many evangelical schools have been started because X is a good place, or X is fertile ground, or whatever.
Right, right.
And then same thing vocationally. Like, this area needs a school of mines. That area needs a liberal arts college, and so on.
Right, right. And then the other question that emerges in my mind is Georgia, you know, became a swing largely as a result of the COVID era, right? I mean, Stacey Abrams, when she tried to run in 2018, famously spent 2019 traveling around the country, going on talk shows and saying the election was rigged, back before that was a bad thing to do. And but then 2020 comes, and all of a sudden, Georgia, let me back that up, that had been so solidly Republican since I moved here in 2002 that I had never seen a presidential ad on TV. All of a sudden, people who are frustrated with the schools being closed down, largely in the sort of New York, New Jersey region, just start moving specifically to Gwinnett County, where I teach, in such massive numbers that by 2022, we've got two Democratic senators, right? So, I mean, that phenomenon is something that I couldn't have even imagined. COVID made it happen. And I mean, I guess once I say it out loud, it'll be obvious that COVID was a more powerful force than either of the political parties. But that moved a solidly Republican state into swing state territory. I guess I'm not enough of a mathematician to understand why an organized political effort couldn't make a smaller tip in one direction or the other.
Well, you'd have to have people who love the party enough to do that, and who can find the kind of work they want to do in the places the party wants them to move, and who want to live in that place. Right?
Yeah.
That combination of things.
Yeah, I guess that is a big ask.
Which is where your example of faculty is a good one, right? Faculty are generally mobile, and I think honestly, faculty probably need to repent of that. Like we will do it because we love teaching, and we will move so we can keep doing what we love. But it is worth wondering if maybe we ought not be more rooted, more willing to stay in one place, even if it means we are doing something else.
Yeah, like teaching high school.
Teaching high school, teaching at a different level, teaching with a commute, or doing something different. As some of these schools in my region have declined, several faculty members have gone to work for the hospital system. I have friends who are working. There some of them are still teaching. They're doing like internal training, but some of them are just doing other work now. And it's the people who have stayed because they are deeply rooted in the community. So I think there's something about the mobility of faculty that probably needs to some attention and discussion as well.
All right, so it needs some discussion, but it's not powerful enough for a party to exploit. Is what I'm kind of hearing today?
Well, I mean, it is. I don't think faculty are the weak link in your plan, right? I mean, I think you could fill up a school. you'd have 10,000 applications, no matter which party was doing it and where, because that's the market these days.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Same thing with administrators and staff. I don't know how many students you would get and how you would pay for it in the long run and accreditation and all of the other stuff that I've mentioned.
Oh, sure.
But
sure.
It's a fun idea.
That makes sense. Well, thank you, Coyle. Like I said, it was something that had occurred to me while I was driving here and there, and I decided finally to write it down, and I said, I'm going to run this by Coyle because this is probably an entirely bad idea, and I need to find out why. And today, listeners, we have found out why. And Coyle, we are about up to the end of our hour. So, I mean, is there anything else that you want to add to this? What is the curriculum at Swing State University?
Oh man, that's I was hoping you were going to have the answer to that. that would depend on where it is and what kind of school you settle on. I think a Swing State diesel mechanic school would be a very interesting one. And we could have some fun conversations about that, but I don't have anything off the top of my head. Anything else that we needed to cover, Nathan? Otherwise, we should probably wrap up.
I think that is about it. So, listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. We do our own editing, assisted by some sometimes incompetent AI. So we're still working that out. Thank you for your patience as we do so. Next time, I'll confess, Coyle, it's the first week of school, so I haven't even looked at what our next episode is about. So I'll post that in the show notes for this. But in the meantime, listeners, thank you for listening to The City of Man. And tune in next time for our next episode.